Thank you for being at Sabbath services today. And I'll let that sink in, because there are so many, I know God commands us to be at services. There are so many other things that can distract us from services. And yet God gives us the opportunity each week to come and to grow and to hear messages, even as we heard in the opening prayer, about his truth, and to move forward in terms of what God deeply desires of us, to become more like him and his son, Jesus Christ. So thank you for being here. Thank you for taking that extra step and being here even on God's Sabbath, and for coming so that you're open and willing to grow in terms of your heart and mind. Those familiar with the book of Job know that it's oftentimes termed a book of whys, W-H-Y-S. A number of commentaries I went to spoke of it as the book of whys, and I hadn't thought about it in that way, but it certainly is fitting. The book begins well, we know that, but then it quickly moves to tragedy and anguish. We read of a man very shortly who loses his wealth, he loses his workers, he loses his children. And then if that's not enough, he then loses his health. And whereas we might think that his wife would step in and be a support, his wife in essence says, curse God and die. At that point, we actually see three individuals enter the picture, that being three of his friends, and they don't say much, even as he's going through the grieving process of what he experiences, for a week. And as we know, having read the book, after they begin speaking, after that period of time, things don't get a whole lot better. In fact, they continue to be difficult. And it's really not until a fourth friend in Elihu who steps in that we start getting kind of some clarity, some positive feedback. It's after Elihu has been there and offered support for Job that God comes into the picture there. Now, God's certainly been watching all of this take place. We know that right up front that Satan said, give me someone to kind of go after. And if you recall there, God says, okay, I'll give you Job. I'll remove that hedge and I'll allow you everything, but you can't take his life. And so what we then see after that point, after Elihu finishes and God steps on the scene, is we actually see four chapters whereby God offers clarity for him. And you might say, well, he already was certainly someone who followed God. We get that sense right up front. But what we find even through the back end when God says, Job, I need you to understand who I am, and I need you to understand who you are. There's a huge chasm between the two of us, and I'm going to make that clear. And I'm also going to make clear the importance of you relying on me, of you acknowledging me, because I need humble obedience out of you. That's what happens. That's what some of the commentaries noted. This notion of humble obedience, even as we deal with God, is this, in the relationship we have, is our part of the equation. When we understand God, when we come to an understanding of who he is and what he expects, we begin to understand the terms of that relationship. And those terms require, we know, to keep his commandments, to keep his Sabbath, to additionally do things like show honor and respect for him through tithing, as we're required. And also, as we are 3 weeks away, to keep his feast days. In a matter of weeks, we actually keep the fall feasts. And even as we anticipate that and we get a sense for what's there, we're reminded of the importance of these days. And we do so, for whatever reason, as I was writing this message, recognizing who God is through this process. We get clarity and we get a connection with God through these days. I'm asking you to turn to Job 42. Job, in a short span of time, we know, goes through so much. Many times, people will oftentimes go through conditions like this, items like this, but they won't do so in such a compressed time, and that's what he's left to bear. And we wind up in Job 42 after God has told Job to examine himself, to consider who he is. Job is going to confess something, and we see it beginning in verse 1 of Job 42. Then Job answered the Lord and said, after God had made very clear to him the difference between them and what God expected, Job answered and said, I know that you can do everything, and that no purpose of yours can be withheld from you. You asked, who is this who hides counsel without knowledge? Therefore, I have uttered what I did not understand. He says, now I'm being forthright. I'm telling you I didn't get it. Things too wonderful, the latter end of verse 3. Things too wonderful for me, which I did not know. Listen, please, and let me speak. You said, I will question you, and you shall answer me. I have heard you by the hearing of the ear, but now my eyes see you. You know, when we read this account, even as I was struck about what God expects of us, might ask ourselves, do we have to go through what Job goes through in order to understand God? Well, thankfully, there are those individuals in Scripture are few and far between that experience anything close to this. But we still can learn from him. We still have an opportunity in a number of different ways to come to a much greater understanding of God by simply obeying him, by certainly knowing of Job secondhand, but of following and obeying God. And one way we might do so, even as we anticipate the fall feast, is by keeping these days, these upcoming days. Now, if you're new to the faith, if you're someone younger that's been called, or if you're, say, older in age but younger in terms of an understanding of God's truth, there probably is some excitement. There's a zeal there. There's an anticipation for what's there because you're curious here. For those maybe who've kept it, there can be a tendency at times to, oh, yeah, here come the feast again. There can be a lethargy that sets in. There can be, oh, we're going to go to the feast or we're going to keep the feast, but, you know, we're just kind of checking boxes here. And what I would ask you to do today, even as we have some sense in realizing we're 3 weeks from the feast, that we kind of consider here the importance and the value of what God's about to do over a very short period of time. We've talked about in times past about how during the period of the fall feast, you get 20%, thereabout, of the messages you're going to hear all year in a very compressed time frame. I would say that we have opportunity to take advantage of this. I would say that we have opportunity here to think through what God is doing through these days, and we up our game for a period of time, even as we anticipate the fall feast. To combat the otherwise possible lackadaisical approach we might have, I would say that it's wise for us to consider, why do we keep these fall feasts? And that's what I'm going to ask that we look at today. If I were to ask you to do a brainstorming exercise and just for a minute list for me all the reasons you could come up for keeping the fall feast, you would probably come up with probably, 8 to 10 really good reasons. I don't have time for 8 to 10. I came up with about that many. But then I distilled them down to 3. So over this message, I'm going to ask that we just look at 3 reasons why we keep the fall feast. And then from there, hopefully in getting in there, doing a deep dive into those reasons, we can actually finish this message with some sense of what Job offers in verse 5. I've heard of you by the hearing of the ear, but now I see you, that we use these upcoming days to their fullest. So I've then entitled this message, Why We Need the Fall Feasts. Why We Need the Fall Feasts. Reason 1. I think this is not going to be a shock. I'll keep many of these pretty simple in terms of language, but we can, again, wander in and through them. The fall feasts remind us right now that this world doesn't work. This world doesn't work. Now, I note that you know this. Some of us, even as we heard Mr. John Beam speak about AI, some of us are taken aback. We are certainly probably at times kind of surprised by what technology is doing right now. The advancement of technology, medical advancement, scientific advancement, abundance of food and things. You may be thinking to yourself, Well, we have it pretty good right now, and in many ways we do. What we oftentimes miss in seeing or in focusing on those elements, and certainly they are to our benefit when used well, is we may miss what's happening below the surface. Now, you have news feeds like I do. With social media, you have an algorithm that's dedicated to you, and it spits information your way. I do, too. What we oftentimes do, and there is certainly advancement in a number of fronts, is at the same time, there's a troubled kind of undertow taking place that many of us see. Now, I say an undertow. All you have to do is turn on the evening news and start seeing what's going on in terms of our society. My wife and I, not too long ago, Sarah and I, for a short period of time, we got into a pattern of watching David Muir, the correspondent or the main broadcaster from ABC Evening News. This was one where Sarah and I just took a little bit of time to watch. In fact, on our DirecTV, I just recorded it, and every once in a while we'll go watch. And I was struck, even as Sarah and I had opportunity to watch, just over several days. If you've not watched the ABC News with David Muir, the broadcast itself is generally about, like any news service is and any news show is, it's bad event after bad event with a cap on the very end for, like, something good is happening in America. In fact, even as Sarah and I watched several times, several episodes in a row at 7 p.m., I found myself at a given point going, wow, this is really bad. We really live at a terrible time. And I say that to you, and you know this, there is a period of time here where we've had catastrophic weather events. It's like, what in the world's going to happen next? What next gets flooded? What next gets wiped out? What next, what additional event is going to happen that's going to deeply impact, if not kill, a large number of people? I was struck by that even as we were watching. Separately, just the events themselves, as we watch, generally negative. No surprise there, because, again, it is the news business. Their aim is to make money on those catastrophic events, on those the crime sprees that we see. You can't watch a nightly news, or you can't watch or go to any news source without seeing two or three or four shootings and deaths. Can't do it. In fact, I kind of dare you. I was teasing with my class the other day. I thought, I want to challenge them to see if they can do this. I'm not sure we can. Even as we were talking about what oftentimes shows up for us in terms of media consumption, rampant crime. It was just this week, and I thought to myself, this was what, Sunday, Monday, thereabouts, when I was still kind of dealing with, and you may have been the same, dealing with the horrific bombing that we happen to have seen over in Gaza. If you happen to watch the news about there, granted, war is just horrible in its own right, but there was that bombing in Gaza, and then there were all these individuals who happened to be up on the hospital trying to save lives, and then next thing you know, there was another bomb, and they were gone. And I found myself just kind of pausing, going, that's the norm today. We just watched the norm. There was no surprise there. And then my brain went to next, so what happens next in the news cycle? Well, I don't have to tell you what happened next. Minneapolis Catholic school shooting happened next, and guess what that does? It next dominates our news cycle. You ask yourself at a given point, well, is this just media? In fact, sometimes we'll have this discussion depending on the way in which we consume media. Is this just media happening? Is media certainly feeding us this? And in reality, it is. I mean, the fact that if we go back like 100 years, we would likely only get our news in smaller snippets, and certainly not with graphic detail. Now you get news cycles, and it just is blown at you over and over and over again. Even as we went through these events, I found myself over and over thinking, wow, this is just not good. Now, again, I've shared with you, and you know this, that we know these events would happen prior to Christ's return. So even as I say this kingdom, the world we live in, or this society we live in, is not God's kingdom, and that's why we need it, a realization that we oftentimes have is just how bad are things? How bad do they get? So I was, even in preparation for this message, I was doing a little bit of research, and I found myself over at an article, for whatever reason, it came up for me on a Google search from 1 year ago. Now, I don't know if you know this, but September 21st is International Peace Day. This article was written in The Telegraph, which happens to be a British newspaper, by Dr. Hanan Balki. This individual is the World Health Organization Regional Director of the Eastern Mediterranean. The article is aptly titled, "The World is Going in the Wrong Direction. We Need Peace More Than Ever." And it reads this way. Each year, on September 21st, is supposed to mark the International Day of Peace. Instead, a whole new front in the conflict, which has been raging in the Eastern Mediterranean region for nearly a year, has opened anew. The truth is that the world is going in the wrong direction, and we need peace more than ever. Today, around the world, 1.8 billion people are struggling to survive in areas where conflicts rage, and the simplest of tasks, like just buying bread and collecting water, can be all but impossible. The U.S. spends $14 trillion in global GDP each year. It's lost to conflict that occurred during that calendar year. The writer goes on to write, "Think about that sum. Imagine how much better our world would be if we were not sacrificing so many precious resources to war and to destruction, but were instead investing them in the health and well-being of the world's most vulnerable citizens." The article then goes on to, even as it kind of wraps up at the back end, to say, "We are in desperate need of peace." I'll read what's offered here. One day during which we can remind ourselves, International Day of Peace, that conflict is not inevitable. It is a human-made catastrophe which humanity can't solve. And then the article tags on the back end that at some point the peace must begin and the war must end. I share this because this was just one of multiple articles that I came across that said exactly that. The same as that what you and I experience, even as we flip on a nightly newscast like ABC Evening News, or just go to any of our news sources, AP, Reuters, Fox, or CNN. It doesn't matter where we go. It's all the same. We happen to live in difficult times, times that we knew were prophesied. Go with me to Matthew 24. We don't have to read far. We don't have to read much in order to recognize that the times we live are indicative of what Christ spoke of would take place before he returned to this earth. Matthew 24, we happen to know in terms of Olivet prophecy, gives us details of those events. And I'm not going to spend time reading it, all of it. I am going to just read a few verses here. We were, again, having a discussion in one of the classes that I had about kind of how hard things are. And the young people that I was listening to, wasn't me kind of baiting them. It was just them dealing with the challenges of life. And they were talking, because I have so many journalists and media studies majors in one class, and they were talking about just what does it mean today to broadcast information, and what bearing does it have on all of us? I'm in Matthew 24, verse 6, if you will. We'll just read a few verses. You will hear of wars and rumors of wars. See that you are not troubled, for all these things must come to pass, but the end is not yet. For nation will rise against nation and kingdom against kingdom, and there will be famines, pestilences, and earthquakes in various places. And all these are then the beginning of sorrows. Now, we know, in terms of those seals of Revelation, that generally those seals opened after Christ came to earth. And we know, though, that they heighten, they get worse over time. Sometimes, again, we can watch nightly news and we can recognize that all of these things happen. And other than the burden of understanding they happen, sometimes we can forget that people are directly involved here. We can minimize that fact. It's oftentimes, though, difficult to minimize what we often are dealing with on our own. 2 Timothy 3. Now, certainly, There are those, whether it be in the Minneapolis area, who are dealing with the trauma of the shooting that took place at that Annunciation Catholic Church. I don't know about you, of late, it's been strange, even as we might choose to go somewhere, whether it be a supermarket or a store, I'll oftentimes catch myself thinking, and I've never done this previously, and I may be the only one in the room who does this. I'll oftentimes think to myself, what would happen if, isn't this strange and odd to think, someone walks in here with a gun? What am I going to do? On many mornings I have shared with you, I'll try and go get some exercise in over the Planet Fitness. I find myself oftentimes, even as I walk in there, thinking, who's in the room? I never did that before. I mean, count me gullible. But I'll think to myself, who is in the room with me? If something happens, where am I going? And that never really crossed my mind. And granted, partially that may be me getting older. It may be me being much more conscious of my environment and what's taking place around us. But it certainly is kind of troubling that this is an ongoing issue, a topic that can come up for us. Separately, I'm over in 2 Timothy 3. One of the things, even as we were talking with some of the students, again, roughly 20 to 25, thereabouts by age, we were talking about these things, and then I had the little gal in the front row who said, you know, I know they're all taking place, but these are not really the things I'm challenged by. I said, so what are you challenged by? What was strange to me is she said kind of verbatim much of what we read here in 2 Timothy 3. She shared some of the struggles, the challenges that she faced just dealing with friendships and technology today. I'll read with you, if you will, 2 Timothy 3, verse 1. But know this, in the last days, perilous times will come. For men will be lovers of themselves, lovers of money, boasters, proud, blasphemers, long list, disobedient to parents, unthankful, unholy, unloving, unforgiving, slanderers, without self-control, brutal, despisers of good, traitors, headstrong, haughty, lovers of pleasure, than lovers of God, having a form of godliness but denying its power. And from these people, sounds like the first message we just heard, turn away. So the strange part, even as I was hearing Mr. Beam speak, is our young people are really having a hard time figuring out what to do with all this stuff, that being internet and building of relationships. I've shared this before. One of the things we know that technology has done is it's really narrowed the number of people that we can rely on, people we call friends, that we can connect with at a sincere level. In fact, in general, those numbers we know over the last several decades have dramatically shortened, have gotten smaller. If you're in a difficult situation, how many of your friends on that social media are going to come help you? And generally, no one does. So what we wind up with is this kind of veneer of friendship. It's a very strange dynamic. This veneer of friendship where we connect with people, but they're not really connections because we don't really spend time with people. We send, you know, quick messages back and forth. We'll send a meme to someone, but it doesn't really build a friendship, certainly not like we've had in the past. And so if you get into the realization of what is a sincere friendship, it's one where, for example, and most researchers will tell you this, that if you have a difficult time, if life gets hard, who do you have that you can rely on? Right now, most numbers are about 1.5 people. Now, I don't know how you count half a person, but that's generally how much they say. There's really only one person, maybe two if we're liberal, that we can rely on today. So it's pretty much changed. Changed pretty considerably again over the last 50, 60 years as technology has come on. At least we need to be mindful of that. So when we see what's here, our realization is that our technology hasn't necessarily made things better. Oh, it's kept us fascinated. It's amused us. But it's also created a number of byproducts from that, a false sense of how the world works. To the end, to the extent to which, and you may have seen this, even this sad news article this week, I'll be interested to see how ChatGPT deals with this lawsuit over the young guy, 15-year-old, who took his own life because AI told him to take his own life. So obviously, he's relying more on a technology than he is on his family or those people who are around him. That's our world. Which certainly should prompt us to look forward to another world coming. A world nothing like what we have now. A kingdom that's unprecedented. Despite the fact, and I have to kind of insert this, despite the fact some might argue, I think the Catholic Church does, that, no, I know the Catholic Church does, that the kingdom is here now, it's not. Believe it or not, that's good news. I went over to Catholic.com to find out exactly what they had to say on the topic, because I've had individuals who said, well, the kingdom is here now. Boy, if this is the kingdom, we got big problems. Matt Fraud on Catholic.com, essentially, I'm going to do a quick paraphrase of what he offers there, says, of the 122 New Testament references to the kingdom of God, we see the kingdom of God is here now. Now, if you go read the details, or you may be Catholic, you may have been Catholic, let me clarify there. If you were Catholic, you know that oftentimes that the Catholic Church believes that the kingdom is here now in the form of the church. And he offers a nuance of explanation, in part referencing Matthew 13, verse 30, that talks about the parable of the wheat and the tares. And so the church is that kingdom. But that's, again, if that's the truth, boy, we have real problems. If this is God's kingdom, this is not a good place to be. I'm reminded, even as I conclude this point or wrap it up, of what Christ said. Go with me to the Sermon on the Mount. You would think that his words were clear enough to recognize that his kingdom was not here. But some confuse that, and sadly, they then are misled. We should not be. I'm in Matthew 6, verses 9 and 10. In this manner, therefore, pray, Christ shares. Now, before that, he leads up to this by saying, don't be a hypocrite. Don't pray in public. Go to your, if you know here, go into your room, and when you shut the door, there pray. Verse 9, in that manner, therefore, pray, our Father in heaven, holy is your name. And sometimes you and I might do the same thing. I'll pray that at the beginning of a prayer, and then I'll stop. I'll stop long enough to make sure the weight of that statement that just came out of my mouth is clear in my mind. Even as we start a prayer, our Father in heaven, holy is your name. And I'll go through the range of different thoughts about how is God holy. In order to, at least for me, to establish clearly and fix in my thinking that there is God there, that he is overseeing everything, and that he is in control. And I'll go through all of those things, thanking him over and over for those things. Which is certainly the reason why Christ told us to do this. Verse 10, your kingdom come. Your kingdom come. God's kingdom is not here. I don't care if someone tells you it is. It is not. And realistically, we have never needed God's kingdom more than now. Even as we see events at times become worse around us. So why would we need the fall feasts? God's fall feasts make clear that God's kingdom is not here. This is not it. If this is it, we are of all people miserable. It is coming. That kingdom is coming. Reason one. Reason two, the fall feasts provide us then a map to that kingdom. The fall feasts provide us a map or a roadmap. I don't care what you list there. To that kingdom. I was reminded years ago of a story. I had to go find the story. It took some digging, but I want to share this story with you about the importance of recognizing, of preparing for some journey we're on. This story actually is one that took place in 1911. At that time, a Norwegian explorer by the name of Roald Amundsen and a British explorer, Robert Falcon Scott, happened to embark on a seemingly evenly matched race to the bottom of the earth to reach the South Pole. Both men were seasoned adventurers of similar age and reputation, and they happened to set off pretty close in terms of time to one another. They knew the conditions they would face would be horrible. Gale force winds, minus 20 degrees Fahrenheit, even in the warmest of months, and a 1,400-mile round trip trek through uncharted ice. Yet despite the comparable starting points, their outcomes could not be more different. Amundsen happened to spend years preparing. He trained rigorously. He studied the path and mastered techniques like dog sledding and survival skills. He even wound up biking 2,000 miles from Norway to Spain to earn his sailing certificate and to test extreme measures. He went so far even to practice consuming things like raw dolphin for nutrition. By age 39, when he set off for the South Pole, he had honed not only his physical abilities, but also a mindset of relentlessness and preparation and foresight. Robert Falcon Scott's planning was a little bit different. By contrast, in this case, he left his team tragically vulnerable whenever he decided to make the trek. Whereas Amundsen relied on proven methods, Scott decided that he would make the trek to the South Pole using ponies, which were completely unsuited for Antarctic conditions, and also motor sledges. And I didn't know what a motor sledge was. It's just a snowmobile. He thought that these would work well, which he found out he and his team didn't work so well. In fact, in short order, they could not keep them in good enough condition in order to make the voyage. Whereas Amundsen happened to mark his path well with visible black flags, he also took preparations by carrying 4 thermometers. He stocked 3 tons of supplies for just 5 men. Enough, as he thought, in order to survive missing every depot, every stop he would have along the way. If he didn't get any of them, they would still be fine. Falcon Scott did something else. He brought 1 ton of supplies for 17 men. He brought 1 single thermometer that broke almost immediately. And he laid inadequate lines, markers along the way, so much so that he couldn't find his way back if he had to. Whereas Amundsen had prepared for the worst weather and unexpected obstacles, Scott largely hoped for the best. So what was the result? Well, on December 15th, 1911, Amundsen planted the Norwegian flag right at the South Pole. At that point, while Scott's team, because they had left right around the same time, was still 360 miles away, by the time Scott reached the pole, 34 days later, Amundsen was already headed home, just 8 days from his home base, and he eventually sailed back to Norway as planned. Whereas Amundsen planted the flag and brought his team home, Scott's frostbitten, starving men never made it home. Their frozen bodies were then found in a tent 8 months later. I share this story because it struck me this way. The tale is a vivid warning about the importance of preparation as we head on a journey. Preparation can mean the difference between triumph or tragedy. It's really up to us. You know, when we think about God's kingdom, sometimes it can feel very disconnected. We talk about it all the time. Sometimes it can feel like church speak. Like, yeah, it's there, but we really can't grasp it. The beauty of what God's fall feasts do is they allow us to grasp it. They allow us to think deeply for a period of time when the rest of the world is not thinking about it at all. They allow us to think deeply about how this future kingdom will be. You know, if we think about it, in practical terms, if I were to tell you, for example, that I had a house that you could have, free and clear, let's go nice house, $500,000, $600,000 house, that I would give you the keys to this house, a beautiful neighborhood, everything is good to go, refrigerator stocked, you'd say, yes, I'm in, tell me where I'm going. And yet sometimes when we think about God's kingdom, we can just kind of put it at arm's length. We won't necessarily give it the thought or the focus that it deserves. And what God's feasts do, the fall feasts particularly, is they again force us to think about what's coming. They allow us to fix on the beauty of that kingdom, on the abundance of that kingdom, on the structure of that kingdom, on the laws of that kingdom, on what takes place in that kingdom. And we can't lose sight of what that is, because that should drive us. That should push us to grow. You know, to be in that kingdom, we certainly have a map to follow. Even as I talked about Amundsen and Scott, they each had their own maps. And in this case, we know Scott fell short because he wasn't necessarily surprised. But this map that is to that kingdom is one of those phrases, at least it came to me when I was writing the message, is hidden in plain sight. It's in our Bibles. And God requires that we keep that map firmly fixed in our thinking every year by keeping holy days. And you know what those holy days are in the spring and the Feast of Weeks through Pentecost, through unleavened bread, unleavened bread and Pentecost, we got the first steps in that kingdom, on that map. Even as upcoming in about 3 weeks, we go further and we understand the next steps. We recognize that those next steps entail the Feast of Trumpets, where Christ will return to this earth. Where the Feast of Atonement reminds us that Satan and his demons will be banished and will be reconciled to the Father. Tabernacles gives us to focus on 1,000 years where Christ sets up his government. And his saints, that would be you and me, we involve ourselves in helping him. And then the 8th day, as we already know here, helps us to recognize that that truth will be provided to everyone. So I share all of that because God's given us a map. It's there. It really becomes important that we take time to think through that map. Now, to this, Leviticus 23, and we'll go through these messages before those fall feasts and during those fall feasts. We'll talk about the meaning of what's there. I'll let you go and read that. And even as we anticipate those days, we're going to dig deeply into those over the course of the next month, month and a half. But it's important for us to go and look and understand what's there. And to not minimize, even as we look forward to travel, and travel is associated with the fall feasts, with the Feast of Tabernacles, it's important for us to not minimize those days that occur prior, trumpets and atonement. Don't miss the meaning of those days with the aim of being ready to go somewhere. Now, to this, I would offer 2 things, even as we anticipate these days, particularly the Feast of Tabernacles and the 8th day. I'm asking you, even in discussions I've had with others, to not view the feast as a vacation. We go to a really nice place, wherever it might be, but the purpose of us going to the feast is not to vacate. Is not to go on a vacation and just look at things. That's not why we're there. We're there to learn from God. We're there to grow in our understanding of what his truth is. We're there to dig deeper so that we are not conformed to this world, but transformed by that experience. We have a privilege of doing so. Some people sometimes go to the feast and they think to themselves, what can I go and what can I see? And I would ask us as the Atlanta congregation to go and see services for what it is, to not miss a day when you're there. And when you're there, to take the time to spend focused time, real time with brethren talking about the meaning of those days. Some feast sites will vary in terms of the activities we have. So if your congregation or your congregation, if your feast site doesn't have as many activities, by all means, plug in those days to fellowship with other brethren, whereas you might be able to take in 2 or 3 really nice locations. And I'm not minimizing, especially if you're going someplace that it's one of those bucket list locations that we want to go and see. That's all fine and good. And God blesses us to do that. But don't allow that to overwhelm what we're doing at the Feast of Tabernacles. Our job at being in a feast is to be there front and center for services and to grow from that experience and to engage in that experience. And if you have to, as I've shared even with our own family, if you have to pull out a calendar because you have vacancies on certain days, there may be no activity, pull out that calendar and take someone out to dinner. Take someone who is less, has maybe less tithe money. Take them out, care for them during the feast. Spend your time doing what God expects us to do. Don't miss that opportunity, because it's a golden opportunity to understand what God's kingdom is really about honoring God and loving one another. So we have a privilege of doing so. So what the feasts offer for us is really a roadmap to that kingdom, a roadmap, as I already shared, that seemingly no one knows. It's really remarkable. Maybe in your place of work, they may say, where are you going? And you'll say, well, I'm going to, you fill in the blank, Daytona Beach, Gatlinburg, wherever it might be, Sabaody, Italy, wherever. It doesn't matter where we're going. And that's well and good. And when they give you opportunity to say, so what are you doing there? It's okay for you to say, I'm there to honor God. That's okay. That is not bad. I'm there to learn more about God. That's okay. It's a privilege for us to say that. It's an opportunity to say that. Let us not forget that. 1 Corinthians 5:8 specifically applies to the spring feast, but I would say that we take the phrase that's there and we make it ours. Let us keep the feasts. Those 4 days upcoming, those 4 feasts upcoming, let us keep and hold those feasts dearly. So why do we need the fall feast? Reason two, I offer, God's feasts provide a map to his kingdom. It's all laid out there. Let's go to my last point, if you will. Reason three, the fall feasts then remind us that we must train for God's kingdom. We must train for God's kingdom. I share this in part because, again, sometimes we can look at going to the feast as a passive activity. I'm asking that we not do that. That our thinking be active, that we understand the investment of time we have. Whereas we know that God's kingdom is coming, God's word really makes clear that once Christ is here and sets up the millennium, he doesn't do so by himself. You know this, I know this. 1 Corinthians 15, 1 Thessalonians 4 say what? At his return, his first fruits will be transformed into spirit beings. That's you and me. That's everyone who's committed their lives to God. Against that backdrop, we'll be given a number of tasks, certainly right up front. We can see this if you go back and even see the Sermon on the Mount. There'll be a lot of people who are hurting that we'll step in and have to support. At the same time, though, we'll also be responsible for teaching. We know this a number of different times, and I've given multiple messages on this. Others have. Revelation 5, verse 10. We can go to the book of Revelation. Revelation 5, 10, which is a memory verse. And it's just a reminder of how God looks at you and me and the expectation he has for us even as we move forward to that kingdom. And by background, we see in verse 9, Christ speaking about being the one who opens the scrolls, slain, his blood being that which redeemed us. And as we get to verse 10, it reads this way, and has made us kings and priests to our God. That's our job. That's our calling. You know, if you think about what a priest does, a priest teaches. And generally, people will oftentimes think of priests or teachers as someone who stands in front of people. And that's right and good, and that's fine. But I'm going to kind of go at this a little bit differently, even as I've shared here. The idea of a priest is, yes, to teach, but it's to teach in a number of different ways. And I ask that you kind of give me a minute here to consider how we can be better teachers, even as we realize that calling. Because what we've been called to is certainly not just teaching any content, but teaching the best content ever. So I would offer in terms of if we're dealing with How do we prepare ourselves to be a teacher, particularly over this time of the fall feast? What should we keep in mind? Well, teaching means we have to know the message. Teaching means we have to know the message. 2 Timothy 2, here's Paul again talking to Timothy and the importance of what it is that we teach. 2 Timothy 2, verse 15, I think about sometimes, and I count it in this case a privilege to be called a teacher, to be able to help people. There's also the realization, and I think I've shared this one before, is that teaching is not about me. There is teachers who are really good, and if you really want to be good at teaching, you are not worried about the me part of any part of teaching. I was years ago, and I've shared this, I think, in previous messages, I laughed when I was teaching a class some time ago, and I had a student who stopped after class and said, I've got you figured out. And I said, do you? And the individual said, yes. I figured out why you became a teacher. And I said, I was waiting for the brag. I said, so why did I become a teacher? And this individual said, because you have no friends. And you needed friends. So you became a teacher. And I said, no, that was not it. And I shared with that young individual, the reason why I became a teacher is hopefully to improve your life just a little, in some way. Teaching to me, teaching to anyone who's of value in teaching, is not about the big name. It's not about the celebrity. It's none of that. A good teacher is about the message. A good teacher, we're just a cog in the wheel. But an important cog, particularly when we deliver God's word to someone, which means we have to know that word. 2 Timothy 2, verse 15, be diligent to present yourself approved to God. This is us, a worker who does not need to be ashamed, rightly dividing the word of truth. It doesn't matter what color I am, how tall I am. It matters none of that. Doesn't matter if my tie is straight. Does none of that matter. Doesn't matter if I'm wearing overalls or a suit. Doesn't matter. You know what does matter? Communicating God's truth. That's what matters. So if we're going to be effective teachers, message is preeminent. We have to know the message. If we don't know the message, we're not anything. We are flash in the pans, just actors. Effective teachers means knowing the message. Effective teachers also, if I can offer a second reason here, means living the message. It's one thing to know something. It's another thing to live it, to model it. Go with me, if you will, to James 1. We've been in the book of James in our Bible studies on Tuesday evening over the last few weeks, and we're in James 2 this next Tuesday. I was struck by, even as I heard us go through this section, Mr. Gerald Ost, on Tuesday at night, about just a reminder of the importance of living what it is that we know. James 1, verse 22, but be doers of the word, not just hearers, only deceiving ourselves. For if anyone is a hearer of the word and not a doer, he's like a man observing his natural face in a mirror. For he observes himself, goes away, and immediately forgets what kind of a man he was. But when he looks into the perfect law of liberty and continues in it, and is not forgetful, not a forgetful hearer, but a doer of that work, this one will be blessed in what he does. This one will be blessed in what he does. So we have this privilege of not just knowing it, which we should know it, but living it. The old phrase, I'd rather see a sermon any day than hear one, that should be you and me. That should be our focus. We don't have to say one word to preach a sermon to people we come in contact with if our behavior if our thinking is right, if we conduct ourselves properly, I don't have to tell you anything. You get it all. They may not understand what you and I believe. They may have no sense of what that is, but they understand a difference when you're around them. Every once in a while, you may have someone who shares that with you. Every once in a while, I'll have a student or I'll have someone else who will come along who will say, I don't know what's different, but there's something different about you. And I'll usually say, is it bad? And they'll go, no, this one's okay. So what we have a privilege of doing in being a good teacher is living that message, modeling that behavior. Last thing I'd offer here is that teaching then also means sharing that message. We can go to the book of Colossians. I picked this section of scripture in these two verses because I like the wording here, because what it reminds me of is there are a number of ways to teach. You can certainly stand in front of people. I get that. But teaching happens in the smallest of moments. Teaching happens whenever we're just dealing with people individually. There's whole sermons taught by some of you this week and the people you've interacted with. Colossians 3, verses 15 through 16 offers this. Colossians 3, verse 15, and let the peace of God rule in your hearts, to which you also were called in one body, and be thankful. Let the word of Christ dwell in you richly in all wisdom. Here's what we're told. Teaching and admonishing one another. So that notion of teaching is sharing information. And then it goes further, which is interesting here, in psalms and hymns and spiritual songs, singing with grace in your hearts to the Lord. So can we transmit a message through, yes, small moments? Yeah, we can. Through maybe even what we sing, what we reference. I wait every year, and this is one of those individual things for me. I wait every year during the feast for one verse to be read, and it sounds silly. This is kind of my thing. And I'm not really sure why this has such a deep emotional connection to me, and I'll make reference to the second section of Scripture in Isaiah 30, and I'll let you go see it on your own, but I want to read what the Message Bible offers here. Isaiah 30, verses 20 through 22. If you remember what this section says, and it gives us a sense forward of how in that coming kingdom, there will be those who guide others. If you recall there, it talks about even as someone may stray from the path, someone is there. You are there in those small moments to teach, to lead, and to guide the right direction. The Message Bible offers this for that section. Your teacher will be right there. And the Message Bible, if it helps, modern day vernacular, local and on the job, urging you on whenever you wander left or right. This is the right road. Walk down this road. And then it adds the following, which I kind of laugh at. You'll scrap your expensive and fashionable God images. You'll throw them in the trash as much as says so much garbage, saying good riddance. Now, the part that I, again, find curious here is kind of how they modernize this. But the reality is that what God offers us as a reminder is that in his kingdom, he'll need those who provide direction for others to be there, to be a support, to offer information, to offer encouragement. A while back, I happened to have heard of a poem, I had to go find it, by a young person by the name of Kevin William Huff. And it's a real simple poem. We're not high on the fanciness here. The poem is entitled, Why God Made Teachers. And I thought, this is fitting. This is a good reminder of the importance that God has, places in you and me to be teachers in the future. It offers the following. When God created teachers, he gave us special friends to help us understand his world and truly comprehend. The beauty and the wonder of everything we see and become a better person with each discovery. When God created teachers, he gave us special guides to show us ways in which to grow so we can all decide how to live and how to do what's right instead of wrong, to lead us so that we can lead and learn how to be strong. Why God created teachers in his wisdom and his grace was to help us learn to make our world, maybe I should say that world, a better, wiser place. God has called you and me to be teachers, not any teachers, his teachers, teachers of his truth. By observing the fall feast, we have opportunity to gain a greater understanding of that plan, and more importantly, his nature, so that we can pass that on to others. So we started in the book of Job, as I shared with you, and I'm not sure even why I was drawn to Job, except the realization of his statement, the statement that he makes after 42 chapters. Even after he goes through so much wrong and so much difficulty, he winds up sharing in Job 42, verse 5, after the worst events possible, I have heard of you by the hearing of the ear, but now my eye sees you. Do we have to go through all that Job went through in order to say, God, I see you? I would contend no. We can take an easier path if we just learn the lesson Job learned. If we learned humble obedience, if we recognize what it means to look to God, to rely on him, to obey him, and that we prepare ourselves to teach others his truth. So the fall feasts are coming, 3 weeks away. They're a time that remembers or recalls or foreshadows when Christ will return, Satan and his demons will be removed, God's kingdom will be established, and everyone eventually will be offered salvation. What are we going to do with this time? Are we going to let it slide by? Are we just going to check a box? Are we really going to invest ourselves in the opportunity to learn about God's coming kingdom and our role in it? It's up to us. Let's take full advantage of these upcoming feasts. They're an invitation to be in God's kingdom as his servants and his teachers, and certainly part of his family.